The kidnapper of the estate agent Stephanie Slater is one of Britain's most dangerous men, according to the policemen leading the hunt for him. They're combining their search with that for the killer of Leeds teenager Julie Dart because of similarities in the two cases.
I want to speak to Kevin Watts quickly, please.
Who's calling?
Never mind.
Hello?
Have you got the money?
Who's this, please?
Never mind. Have you got the money?
And whatever the outcome, I'll always love you.
Welcome to Crime Labs. I'm Eileen.
And I'm Charlie.
There is often an argument of whether someone is born to become a violent criminal, or if a sequence of events lead them to do an unthinkable act. This nature versus nurture argument is one that comes into play when investigators are trying to track down a killer, especially a killer that seems to be rapidly escalating. There are many killers and criminals who use codes and ciphered communications to taunt the police. This type of action exerts more torture and control over many people. It is a power play that feeds the writer's ego, knowing that they are on the minds of many. When human lives become something to play with, the game becomes much more dangerous. This is Ransoms and Riddles.
On Friday, 12th of July, Dominic Murray received a handwritten letter from his partner, 18-year-old Julie Dart. The letter detailed that Julie had been kidnapped. The letter read, quote, "Hello, Dominic. Help me, please. I've been kidnapped, and I am being held as a personal security until next Monday night. Please go and tell my mum straight away. Love you so much, Dominic. Mum, phone the police straight away and help me. Have not eaten anything, but I have been offered food. Feeling a bit sick, but I'm drinking 2 cups of tea per day. Mum, Dominic, help me." Unquote. Dominic alerted Julie's mother, Lynn Dart. The pair set out on a search around Leeds to find Julie. They found a lot of people who knew Julie, but no one had seen her since the 4th of July, around a week before this. The pair alerted the local police force.
I can understand the letter. It didn't make sense. Oh, would kidnap Julie. And who'd want her for ransom? Because I thought I'd have got a letter saying I want so many thousands of pounds. It just didn't make sense. It was all in a whirl.
Julie had told her family that she worked night shifts at the local hospital, so they contacted the hospital to ask if they had seen Julie. But they were met with the news that the hospital had absolutely no record of Julie as a staff member. While Julie's family had received their letter directly from Julie, Leeds City Police also received a letter. This letter detailed that, quote, "a prostitute," unquote, had been kidnapped from the Chapeltown area and would be killed if a ransom was not paid. The ransom was set at £140,000. This letter was written using a stencil. The letter went on to threaten to firebomb a city centre store, as well as kill the kidnapped woman. Both the letters were marked as Huntington and sent on the same day. Both of these letters were given to Superintendent Bob Taylor of West Yorkshire Police due to their locations. The letter requested for a courier to take the money to a set location. It specified a woman, even detailing what clothes she was to wear. The courier was to package money and wait at a telephone box at Birmingham New Street Station. The phone rang, but no message came through.
The courier waited for 20 minutes, but there were no further phone calls, so the operation was abandoned. We'd done everything that the blackmailer had asked, and all we could do now was to wait for him to make the next move.
A week after the letters were received, on the 19th of July 1991, a body was found. Badly decomposed but identifiable as that of Julie Dart. She had been dumped in a field near an old railway in Lincolnshire. Witnesses confirmed that Julie had been working in a local red light district as a sex worker. Clinical pathologist Paul Britton joined the investigative team. They found injuries to Julie's skull, suspected to be caused by a hammer, but this was not convincing as the cause of death.
My preliminary examination of the body did not reveal a positive cause of death. There were some injuries to the scalp. There was one at the back of the scalp, and there was one to the left, above the left ear. And underneath that injury, there was a fracture of the skull. Now, these injuries were consistent with being caused by an instrument such as a hammer, but they were by no means convincing causes of death.
The killer followed up on the discovery of Julie's body with a second letter. This one described the killer's upset that Julie, quote, had to die, unquote. It went on to explain that they did not want any more prostitutes to die. They warned what would happen if the instructions were not followed. The ransom money was still required, set at the same price. The letter continued that if the police wanted to comply, an ad should be placed in the Sunday newspaper to read, quote, "Let's try again, for Julie's sake," unquote. There was now no doubt that the author of these letters was Julie's killer. Police arranged for the newspaper ad to be placed, and 3 days later, another letter was received. This time, the letter was handwritten. This letter warned how another hostage would be taken if the second attempt at a money drop-off was not successful. The killer again detailed what the courier should be wearing, even including betting odds, evidently playing a game with the police. Paul Britton claimed this person was a, quote, "complex games player," unquote. Claiming this killer may have taken a prostitute as practice for whatever may come next, it was evident they were not yet finished. The investigation team reached a point of desperation, knowing they lay in the hands of a killer, knowing that the killer knew they held this power too, was frustrating for the team.
As the days passed and the team's frustrations grew, another letter arrived. This letter, following the same manner as the last, described how the killer hadn't been able to get another hostage yet. Another letter, almost identical, was received thereafter. Eventually, the killer arranged for the police to drop the ransom money at a telephone box up the A638. With young girls going missing locally, the police couldn't take the chance that the killer had not taken another prostitute or similar hostage. With this in mind, they set out to the pre-agreed meeting place. Once at the telephone box, the phone rang. The voice claimed they would call back in half an hour with further instructions. Then the phone eventually sprang to life once more, but the receiver had broken. The courier desperately tried to fix the telephone to no avail. No further calls were received. Incredibly disheartened, the police combed the area surrounding the telephone box for clues. They came across a brick. The brick was found painted in white with a note attached. Next to the brick was a tin can with a wire sticking out of the top and a small red bulb attached, making this item look like an explosive device. Workmen had called the item into the police, who confirmed it was not an explosive, but the note was almost certainly from their killer. The note read, quote, "Message, next bridge, 400 metre, 2 min. Allow, detector on panel, carry money," unquote. South Yorkshire Police circulated the details of the note, and they visited the scene. The arranged WPC followed instructions which they deciphered as placing the explosive dummy on the dashboard of the car, in sight through the windscreen. They drove up towards the described bridge. The police assumed the kidnapper would be located on top of the bridge. They would then drop something down to collect the money, pull it up, and make their escape. Because of this, police presence in the surrounding area was extensive. In the first letter, the killer had drawn a bundle of money attached to a loop being pulled upward by a dog lead. But to the team's dismay, no one was there.
A letter later arrived at Leeds Police Station saying that the game was over. There is no hostage. The killer knew after murdering Julie Dirt that the police would cooperate and they wouldn't need another hostage to do so. The letter went on to explain that Julie's body was so decomposed because she had been kept in a wheelie bin for, quote, 2 very hot days, unquote. The police were sure the killer would return, and the investigation continued. A brick technologist examined the brick that was left on the motorway. He managed to reveal there was only one company manufacturing these bricks. It was a rare brick, a, quote, 1 in a million product, unquote. The suspected bomb had been blown up by the police in a controlled environment to ensure it was not an explosive. Now, scientists were trying to put the pieces back together. The tin that was also present was recognised by an officer. The officer was an owner of a tropical fish and he said it was a known fish food tin. The only other clues present were the words used, many misspelled. Another letter arrived at the police station, quote, "As you are nowhere near my tail," unquote, the killer wanted their £140,000. A female police officer, WPC, was expected to meet them on the 21st of October with the money. At the same time, a letter was also sent to British Rail asking for £200,000, threatening to derail a train if they did not pay. The two money drops were to happen too close together, so the police decided to defer one of the drops, still agreeing that the killer would get their money, just at a later date. Another letter followed, threatening to, quote, "send a message," unquote, for deferring the payment date. Shortly after, another large brick was found hanging under a bridge that a train line runs under. Although no damage was reported, it could have caused severe and potentially fatal damage to the train, its driver, and passengers.
We decided that it would be not to our advantage to run the operation in respect of British Rail on the same day that he was making a ransom demand against the Julie Dart team. Both would have involved extremely large surveillance, very close together with all the inherent dangers. So we decided to defer our operation, not to refuse him payment, but to defer the operation.
On the 22nd of January 1992, 25-year-old Stephanie Slater, an estate agent working for Shipways in Great Barr, West Midlands, went out to a viewing with a man. She did not return to the office later that day, and her office received a call from a man claiming he had Stephanie and that he would kill her if Shipways did not pay him. Stephanie's manager contacted the police. Uniformed police officers immediately attended the offices of the estate agency, which they later reflected was a bad move in a potential kidnap case, especially as during the call, the kidnapper had detailed if anyone was told, Stephanie would die.
Kidnaps are an extremely rare offence, aren't they, thankfully? I mean, I think I've only known three in 28 years in the police force. We get lots of different hoaxes in relation to this sort of offence. And at the beginning of this inquiry, uniformed officers were sent to the scene. That was definitely a mistake. We recognised that very, very quickly. Withdrew the officers from the scene and replaced them with covert officers so that we wouldn't prejudice Stephanie's life.
Covert agents took over and attended the property where the viewing had taken place. There they found Stephanie's car left outside of the property. The keys for the house were just inside, with what appeared to be blood on them. And there was some blood found in an upstairs room too. Technology was installed at the estate agency, covert listening devices attached to all the phones, ready for the kidnapper to make further contact. The kidnapper called Shipways again and appeared to open negotiations. This implied Stephanie was alive and well. Arrangements were made for the ransom money to be delivered. The kidnapper requested the manager of the estate agency, Kevin Watts, to deliver the money completely alone. The press were informed, but a media blackout was requested until Stephanie was safely returned home. The police were granted rare access to intercept all mail sent to Shipways, and amongst the post, a cassette was found. On it was a recording of Stephanie assuring her colleagues and family that she was well and unharmed.
Stephanie Slater, the time is 11:45. I can assure you I'm okay and unharmed. Providing these instructions are carried out, I will be released on Friday the 31st of January. For next Wednesday, you will need an ordnance survey map. Number 103, Blackburn and Burnley. Kevin Watts must be the person to act as courier and use his car. Next Wednesday at every point, where instructions are given, boot of the car must be opened for at least 30 seconds. The money must not be marked in any way whatsoever, or contain any device whatsoever.
The day of the money drop-off arrived and a K-9 unit was dispatched, undercover to check the surrounding area of Stephanie's kidnap to ensure a body had not been dumped prior to the cash drop. Upon interviewing neighbours to the property Stephanie viewed with her kidnapper, one of the neighbours confirmed seeing a man standing outside the house in question on the day and gave a visual description. The secrecy of the inquiries made everything more difficult. The police described the investigation as if they were working with, quote, one arm behind their back, unquote. Police were also present at Stephanie's parents' home, intercepting incoming calls there too. The phone rang, and it was Stephanie. She confirmed live football scores to prove she was alive prior to the ransom being delivered.
Hello, Stephanie. It's me to make a message to you, just to let you know that I'm all right. I'm unharmed. I happened to see West Bromwich Albion lost yesterday to Swansea 3-2. I want you to know I love you and not to worry too much. And whatever the outcome, I'll always love you. Look after the cat for me.
Stephanie's employers put up the ransom money and the police began to prepare Kevin Watts for the drop. The police were concerned for Kevin, how he would handle such a high-pressure situation. They worked with him to prepare him mentally and physically for the evening in question, warning him that even some highly trained officers find these situations difficult. The plan for the drop involved up to 1,000 police officers. They were prepared to travel anywhere in the country, mainly ready for a location up north. They had arranged to arrest the kidnapper at the drop. Kevin left his family home. He signed I love you in the air to his wife as he left. He claimed that he felt safe. He felt the police would protect him. But his wife, Julie Watts, was extremely concerned. She remembered closing the door after saying goodbye to Kevin that day and breaking down in tears.
They simply asked whether I would be willing to be the courier. And I said yes, anything to ensure the safe release of Stephanie. They spent an awful lot of time with me, coaching me, putting me really in the right mental frame of mind to cope with the stresses and strains that I would endure during that evening. My wife and family were at the door waving me off. I wrote the letters in the air, I love you, to my wife. It never crossed my mind that I wouldn't see my wife again. I had every confidence that the police on the evening, as well as myself, would make sure that I returned safely.
The day of the drop arrived, and the kidnapper called Kevin Watts and confirmed he should go to Glossop Station, Western Manchester, and wait inside the telephone box there. Further instructions would arrive to that phone at 7 p.m. Once in the telephone box, the 7 p.m. phone call arrived and instructed Kevin to travel to another phone box and retrieve a message 200 yards down the road. Detailed written instructions were waiting there for him, with driving directions to yet another telephone box. The phone box was off the main town centre roads. With a heavy fog descending, Kevin couldn't see further than 5 or 6 feet in front of his windscreen. Kevin felt safe and connected to the police as he had a two-way microphone attached to his body. However, as he travelled further towards the phone box, he lost connection with the police. He was completely unaware of this. And when he arrived at the destination, he was completely alone. A sign was in the middle of the bridle path Kevin was travelling down. It was a Shipways logo. Kevin continued past the sign down the track. Once he arrived at the destination, communication between himself and the police was completely non-existent. Kevin was surrounded by heavy fog, bushes, and old crumbling walls. He was terrified. He recalls feeling like his mind was being twisted. He discovered another note directing him to yet another telephone box. Further down the road, the walls on either side began to get higher and higher. There was a cone in the centre of the road which read, "Stop." 60 seconds allowed on wall by 4 sign, wood tray. Do not move tray, sensor inside. Put money and bag on tray. If buzzer does not sound, leave money there. Remove cone in front of the car and go. Money will not be collected until you have left. Kevin followed all commands. He didn't even feel in control of his own mind at this point. Whilst driving away and back home, Kevin's communication with the police came back on. finding out that the money had been dropped and realising that the kidnapper had made off with it. But with no knowledge that Stephanie was alive and well was not the news they wanted to report back to the Slaters.
A family liaison officer went to the Slaters to explain what had happened that evening and to comfort them. After a while, there was a knock at the door of the Slaters' family home. It was Stephanie. After over a week, she was finally free.
And it was only me brushing Adrian aside, and I said, "It's Stephanie." And we just grabbed her and pulled her in the house.
Appearing drugged, physically pinching herself and digging her nails deep into her forearm skin, trying to ensure she really was back safely at home, Stephanie was physically okay. She was taken to a private hospital to be monitored and debriefed. The police finally felt like the power was back in their hands, but where was the kidnapper? Neighbours confirmed a sighting of an orangey-red, early-type mini-metro with what appeared to be a drunk woman exiting it around the time Stephanie arrived back home. The police followed directions to find out where Kevin had dropped the money. The walls he remembered surrounding him were in fact the parapets of an old railway, under which ran an abandoned track, which led also to where the brick had been found in the Julie Dart investigation. Instead of rope being used to hoist money up, this time there was a washing line left to drag the money down. There was also, once again, a dummy explosive covered in silver paint found on the track. The media blackout had now ended. The kidnapper was described as, quote, one of Britain's most dangerous men, unquote.
The kidnapper of the estate agent Stephanie Slater is one of Britain's most dangerous men, according to the policemen leading the hunt for him. They're combining their search with that for the killer of Leeds teenager Julie Dart because of similarities in the two cases.
During Stephanie Slater's inquiry and the time that she was missing, we were dealing with someone who had probably murdered the previous girl he'd had dealings with. Had there been one mistake, one error, or one police officer seen, I have no doubt whatsoever, none at all, that he would have killed her.
The combined inquiry continued and Tom Cook took over as lead. The detectives needed to speak further with Stephanie. She explained how she was gagged, blindfolded, and her hands bound together. Stephanie was, for all intents and purposes, a fantastic witness. She was able to recall information in great detail, which helped the investigation immensely. Discussing the events immediately after the viewing, Stephanie described the journey in the kidnapper's car. She was made to lie in the passenger seat with a rope around her neck to stop her sitting up. A coat was placed over her head while a knife was pressed against her stomach. When the car came to a stop, she heard keys and a heavy door being pulled open. The kidnapper took her out of the car. He gave her new clothes to wear, which consisted of a pullover cardigan, some old jeans and socks. He also placed the socks on top of her hands to protect her from the handcuffs. He offered her fish and chips for tea, which she accepted. He told her to be quiet, and he left to get the food. When he returned, he moved her to a mattress to eat. When she had finished eating, he made her lie in a small coffin-like hole, gagged and blindfolded. He threatened that there were boulders above her, and if she moved, she would be electrocuted and the boulders would crush her. She was bitterly cold all night, with terrible pain all over her body, especially her back. Stephanie spent the night feeling as if she was dying, and at one point, she thought she was dead. When the next morning arrived, Stephanie was in so much pain she could barely move. She claimed her kidnapper appeared genuinely surprised to find her in so much pain. He rubbed her arm and offered her a cup of tea. Stephanie thought that if she spoke to him and he realised she was human, it would make it more difficult for him to kill her. After this conversation, Stephanie claims he appeared calmer and, quote, trusted her, unquote. He would make her porridge for breakfast in a microwave. She recalls certain sound details such as the bell from an old cash register, an old-style telephone that rang a couple of times, and a railway badge on his jacket. She was constantly compliant and always did as she was told. When taking the statement, the police believed Stephanie became important to the kidnapper. They were sure he would try and make contact with Stephanie following her release.
Stephanie Slater is very lucky to be alive. If it hadn't been for her temperament, I think she could have very well been killed. She didn't panic. She was compliant. She did as she was told by the kidnapper. In due course, she became extremely important to him as a person. And I think that that's what kept her alive. So much so that I was able to advise the investigating officers that after her release, there was a very good chance that the offender would try to make some sort of contact, either with her or with other people involved in the investigation.
On the day of the money drop, the kidnapper had told Stephanie she could return home. He said he would return to her place of captivity between 8 and 9 p.m. He removed her blindfold but demanded she kept her eyes closed so he could take a picture of her, to remember her by. He put her back in the box, and when 9 p.m. came and went, Stephanie became frantic. She didn't want to starve to death. She simply felt she could not go on. Committing suicide crossed her mind. She considered suffocating herself to death. At around 10:45 p.m, she heard him return. He released her from the box, and she pleaded with him to allow her to go home. At around 11:15 p.m, they got in his car and began the journey back to Birmingham.
Since this case was all over the news and media, the kidnapper had clearly seen the things being said about him, and this prompted him to send a letter to the BBC. In this letter, the kidnapper claimed to be, quote-unquote, disgusted at his treatment of Stephanie. He expressed deep remorse but said he was not responsible for the murder of Julie Dart. As the kidnapper had called using his own voice, the police had a recording of him which they planned to release on Crime Watch, along with the visual portrayal collected from neighbours and the car description too.
I want to speak to Kevin Watts, quickly please.
She's calling.
Never mind.
Hello?
Have you got the money?
Who's this, please?
Never mind. Have you got the money?
The team expected a high volume of calls following the Crime Watch episode and were prepared to wade through what would ultimately be a lot of time-wasting conversations. However, immediately after the segment, a call came directly through to the Julie Dart incident room, which was unusual, yet this call appeared, answered by DC Greenwood. The caller said the police could stop their search. She knew who the kidnapper was. The caller identified herself as Susan Oak. She said the voice she heard on Crime Watch was undoubtedly her ex-husband, Michael Sams.
I felt like I was betraying my children, because I knew that this was their father, and I knew it was going to hurt them, and I knew it was going to hurt me, but it was something I had to do. So it's mixed emotions, because I was thinking of his mother and his wife. There's every emotion it's possible to feel, you feel all at once, but you know that you've got to do it, so you just get on and do it.
Susan was able to confirm the car the neighbours had seen as the one belonging to Michael Sams, as she had seen him at a family funeral a few days prior, where he had refused to give her a lift in the same vehicle.
Michael Benjamin Sams was born on the 11th of August 1941 in West Riding, Yorkshire, England. He joined the Merchant Navy at 20, and after 3 years returned to Keighley to work as a lift engineer, ultimately training and setting up his own business. He was married to his third wife at the time of Stephanie Slater's kidnap. He was the father of two children, mothered by his first wife, Susan Oak. He had been sent to prison shortly after his marriage to Susan broke down. His criminal activities began in 1976, when he was first sentenced to serve a prison sentence for auto theft and making a false insurance claim. Whilst in prison, a diagnosis of cancer resulted in the amputation of his right leg, which meant Sams walked with a limp. The police went straight to Sams' home and were met by his wife, who claimed her husband had warned her police may come round since the Crime Watch programme mentioned a metro. She seemed amused and told the police where Michael worked. They headed to T&M Tools, and on their way there they noted the road leading to the workshop at a slope, and the car park bared to the right, just as Stephanie had described. They saw the metro parked outside, and a sign for the shop had been written using a stencil, just as the letters had been. Inside, they found Michael Sams. They also found everything Stephanie had mentioned. The radio, tuned to Radio 2, the old-style telephone, the wooden beams, and the big, heavy doors. They arrested Sams for the murder of Julie Dart and the kidnap of Stephanie Slater. Once they arrived at the station, Sams was placed in a holding area. He appeared distressed and pale, when he said, quote, I kidnapped Stephanie Slater, but I didn't murder Julie Dart. You'll find £19,000 at the workshop with my confession, unquote. Detective Sergeant Tim Grogan knew he needed to get Sams to repeat this omission to the sergeant. Sams explained every step of the drop and the run-up to the event. He confessed to burying the rest of the money, but refused to tell them where, quote, at the moment, unquote. He also denied anyone else's involvement. He continued to deny any involvement in Julie's murder.
A 50-year-old local man was arrested in Newark, Nottingham, and is being held in connection with the kidnapping of Stephanie Slater. He is expected to be charged in the near future.
Police began inquiries through all the family and friends of Michael Sams. An interview with Carl Metcalf, who knew Sams in the early 70s, said Sams was a nice guy, but he also had, quote-unquote, another side. He remembered Sams admiring the great train robbers, master criminals, but always claimed to Carl that he could do it better and that one day he could commit, quote, the perfect crime, unquote. One day he was messing around with a model railway and Carl asked him if Sams wanted a side room rendered, to which Sam replied, quote, no, that's for the hostage, unquote. Forensic searches were well underway in Sams's workshop, finding hair that could have been from either of the women, blood stains on the bottom of some curtains that was watery, and it appeared to have soaked up the curtains when someone was cleaning it up from the floor. This blood was proved to be of the same blood group as Julie Dart. The mustard-coloured tufts of fibre found in the wrapping that concealed Julie's body were also found at the workshop. Sams called for the interviewing officers the following morning. He changed his story at this point, claiming someone else was involved, a second man. He was driven by someone else to all of the phone boxes to leave the various notes. He claimed that in the car on the way back to his workshop, driven by his accomplice, an argument broke out. Apparently, the accomplice had said they were going to kill Stephanie. Sams allegedly fought against this idea and agreed to pay the second man £20,000 in exchange for Stephanie's life. The police asked for the name of the second man, which Sams refused to give, said he couldn't because the second man might, quote, take it out, unquote, on Stephanie or another victim. Police concluded that this was a way to turn any evidence found linking him to the murder and kidnaps away from Sams.
There is nothing to suggest that he is working with an accomplice at this particular moment in time. As far as the Dart inquiry is concerned, we have always worked on the assumption that the killer of Julie Dart was working alone.
Quote, it's impossible, unquote, he said when forensic evidence was revealed to Sams. He then changed his story once again, as he realised he couldn't get away with this explanation in court. Time and time again, evidence was presented to Sams, who sat and insisted it could not be possible and refused to change his story. He would then go to a cell alone and reconsider, call for the officers once more and change his story, usually involving this second man.
I believe that the mistake that Julie Dart made when you had her confined was that she had tried to escape or remove that blindfold. And that is why she saw where she was. She saw you. And she had to die. Is that the truth?
No, it isn't the truth. There's no truth in that whatsoever.
And so, Julie Dart was not as fortunate, or not, shall we say, not quite as compliant with your instructions as Stephanie Slater was. And in fact, I think through her complying with your instructions to the letter is the only thing that saved Stephanie Slater's life.
Stephanie would have gone home any time.
Julie Dart didn't go home. She ended up naked in a field in Lincolnshire.
But I didn't do that. I can guarantee, I know
it's because she didn't comply with your instructions, isn't it?
Totally wrong there.
Not totally wrong.
You are totally wrong there.
They requested a handwriting sample from Michael Sams, who surprisingly complied. The handwritten letter was taken by motorcycle immediately down to Birmingham, where the handwriting specialist was waiting, with the previously handwritten letters retrieved from the multiple scenes. The specialist, Paul Rimmer, confirmed his certainty that the York and Coventry letters were written by Michael Sams. Given this news, Sams maintained that he did not write them. despite 14 identical spelling mistakes, he claimed that these were purely coincidental.
That's a lovely thing, yes.
This doesn't bring back any memories.
Yeah.
Words will never be able to express my regret that Julie Dowd had to be killed.
Yeah.
But I did warn what would happen if anything went wrong.
Nope.
Doesn't at all.
No, one little bit.
The reason the body deteriorated so quick was that it was kept in a wheelie bin in a greenhouse for two very hot days. I thought this was the best way to keep the body. Her head was wrapped in a towel. But when this was removed to clean her up before dropping her, her hair came away, stuck to the blood on the towel.
No, I don't mean anything to me, but...
Once again, he went away and came back with a different story. He admitted this time that he did in fact write the letters, claiming his accomplice forced him to write the letters. He was playing a huge game with the police. They saw that he was creating this dustbin-like character in front of their eyes. The image he portrayed of himself was very positive. The person that committed the brutal murder of Julie Dart and the kidnapping of Stephanie would never have such characteristics, or so Michael imagined. So he created a different version of himself, a whole other person, so he could blame any bad parts of himself on this character instead.
The relationship developed within 5 minutes, within 10 minutes. As soon as I knew what I was doing, it didn't really dawn on me what I was doing until I did it. It was only planned, and then once I'd started, yeah, it dawned on me then. That was the emotional side I could not ever plan for. You can't tell me how I felt when I had it. You've no idea.
Why did you let it go?
It isn't the same feeling that you've got punishing me now. It's completely different.
The evidence against Sam's was overwhelming. What was missing was the money. He claimed this other man had the money. If the police could find the money, this would finish the investigation. There was a freshly dug hole near Sam's house where he denied the money was buried. Police felt that at the time of the photo fit being released and the media coverage, Sam felt he had no choice but to move the money. It would make sense that the money be moved to another place Sam was familiar with. During one of his interviews, the police confronted Sam with the information that in the previous July, two witnesses had seen a man with a walking stick on a private road less than a mile away from where Julie Darrett's body had been found. Another witness saw a red Metro on a disused railway track which runs past a field where Julie's body had been found. They asked if either of these times could have been him. He denied this. He said he didn't know those areas at all. The only time he'd been near there was to go train spotting at a place called Stoke Summit. The police began to suspect the money may be buried there, or around local areas suitable for train spotting. His train spotting outing was the 19th of February, which was after he released Stephanie Slater and the day before the Crime Watch episode, which prompted a police search of the area for the missing money. On the 1st of December 1992, the search at Stoke Summit began. Nothing was found. The next day, a member of the workforce found a large target below the ground surface. They began to dig and recovered a large sum of money. They believed to be the full £140,000. They weren't able to count it as it would have disrupted the evidence. Still in custody, Sam saw a newspaper the following day reporting the police had found the money. He requested to speak with the team where he claimed they had in fact only found half of the money. Police were concerned this may mean the mystery second man did in fact have a chunk of the ransom. Sam explained he had packaged up the money but the other man had buried it. He claimed he didn't know exactly where, but he believed it might be in the same vicinity as the money they had already recovered. A small group of officers returned to Stoke Summit, and 16 feet away from the first find, they found an area of soft ground, under which they unearthed another sum of money. It knocked the second man theory for six. If there was a second man, he'd had 9 months to return to take the money for himself. Michael Sams was put on trial in the summer of 1993 for kidnapping Stephanie Slater, blackmailing her employers, and kidnapping and murdering Julie Dart. The trial lasted 22 days. The jury found him guilty of kidnapping and murdering Julie Dart, two attempts of blackmailing the police and blackmailing British Rail. He didn't react when the sentence was passed and the public gallery broke into a round of applause. Julie Dart's mother shouted, quote, "You bastard," unquote, before breaking down into tears. Michael Sams maintained his innocence in Julie Dart's murder throughout his trial. Regardless of this, he was found guilty on every charge and given 4 life sentences. 4 days later, he changed his story for the last time and admitted that he did murder Julie Dart. He stated that the only reason for his confession was Lynn Dart, Julie's mother. He said he felt sorry for her. Lynn said she didn't want his pity. She didn't feel like he had any remorse for Julie, the young woman he had killed in cold blood.
All that going through it, and he's waited till afterwards, and he's confessed. Because he felt sorry for me. You know, it's just the cheek of the man. You know, he felt sorry for me. You know, but it's not me I want him to feel sorry for, it was Julie. You know, and he still felt no remorse for Julie.
Michael Sams had tried to get money by abducting someone in July 1991. He constructed a holding cell in his workshop and set off to find a victim. He targeted Julie Dart in Leeds and lured her into his car, threatening to stab her if she didn't comply with his commands. While Julie was tied to a chair in his makeshift dungeon, he made her pen a letter to her fiancé asking for a ransom in exchange for her freedom. Sams had made an enclosure from wood and sheets of metal. When he left that night, his phone rang. He had rigged the enclosure to alert his phone if Julie tried to escape. When he went back to the workshop, he found Julie, who had desperately broke free from the cell but was trapped inside. Infuriated, Michael Sams beat Julie to death with a hammer. He wrapped her body in blankets and dumped her remains in a field near Huntington the following day. Michael Sams still tried to extort money from Julie's desperate family, despite her death. He communicated with the police through personal ads in a newspaper, but when Julie's body was found, the game was up. Michael Sams tried again, though. He kidnapped Stephanie Slater from a house and kept her hostage for 8 days. While Sams had fine-tuned his kidnapping skills, he didn't plan on beginning to feel something for Stephanie. Her resilience and dedication to making sure he knew she was a living person, with a life, meant he was conflicted about killing her. Stephanie survived. When Michael Sams was found guilty at his trial, she thanked the jury. Stephanie went on to write a book where she detailed the full horror of her ordeal. Michael hadn't just kept her captive, he had raped her too. At the time, Stephanie felt unable to disclose the sexual abuse, wanting to maintain her dignity and forget it ever happened. But her life was never the same. She suffered from panic attacks and had to leave her job. Her relationship was also affected. She said she felt as though she died in January 1992, and so she changed her name to Phoenix Rhiannon for a time. Keith Wilkinson, an ITV News correspondent, made a TV documentary with Stephanie about her ordeal and became close friends with her in the 90s. He said, quote, "Stephanie never got over what she went through. She suffered with terrible nightmares, great trauma. She lived in fear that one day Sams would be released on parole. She had a lot of backache and blamed this on the awful pain she felt during her abduction. In a very cold, dark conditions, she was locked up in a wooden box which was inside a wheelie bin. She was ordered to keep still or face electrocution. Stephanie's life wasn't all doom and gloom, but the terrors of what happened to her never left her. They had an awful impact on her and her parents," unquote. Stephanie liaised with the police to improve how they interacted with kidnapped victims and would help other kidnapped victims overcome their own trauma. She wrote a book, which was released in 1995, titled Beyond Fear, My Will to Survive. Michael Sams had the audacity to try and sue her for libel after it was released. His attempt was unsuccessful, but drove Stephanie to have a mental breakdown. She said, quote, "It felt as if I was being raped all over again. I was taking antidepressants and drinking heavily to stop the flashbacks and nightmares. I was drinking 2 bottles of wine a night in the hope of sinking into some kind of oblivion," unquote.
While in prison, Michael Sams had his legs stolen by notorious long-term prisoner Charles Bronson. The two were both incarcerated in Birmingham's Winston Green prison. Bronson said in an interview that it was the, quote, "best time," unquote, he had there. Michael Sams continued to try and get money while in prison. He sued the prison 3 times, once for the loss of 8 of his personal paintings, for which he was awarded £3,500. He also sued for a loss of earnings while he was held in segregation, and finally, for his mattress being too hard. Michael Sams hasn't served his time with dignity. He's tried to go back to court numerous times, most recently in 2012 to recategorise his prison status from Category A to low risk. He'd tried three times before. He craves the attention. On the 31st of August 2017, Stephanie sadly died following a short battle with cancer. She was 50 years old. In the years of her life following her kidnapping, Stephanie battled to shake off her past. Her best friend, Stacey Kettner, paid tribute to her following her death, saying, quote, "I know that she truly never got over the events that changed her life so dramatically in January 1992. It's been an honour and a privilege to be Stephanie's best friend." Unquote. Julie Dart fought for her life and was killed for it. Stephanie Slater did not fight and lived to be freed. It was a hard life. While Sams did not murder Stephanie, he denied her any semblance of a normal life.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you've liked what you heard, please share and review. Follow us on social media at Crime Labs Podcast and at Crime Labs Pod. We'll be releasing episodes bi-weekly for the foreseeable future. If you want to join us as a patron, you can join on patreon.com/crimelapse. We have some exciting new merchandise to send out, and we'll have new episodes coming very soon, exclusive for our patrons.